いいね。
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Headlines: Russia and China accuse the United States of trying to destroy international legal architecture and trying to rely on Cold War era military and political alliances. Iran says the war in Yemen has no military solution, calling for a ceasefire and an end to the Saudi blockade on the Arab country. Also coming up, Israelis vote in the fourth election in less than 2 years, with voters still divided over whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu deserves to remain in office. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. China and Russia believe the U.S. is trying to destroy international legal architecture. That's according to a joint statement by the Russian and Chinese top diplomats. The statement accused the U.S. of relying on Cold War-era military and political alliances. It also blasted European and Western sanctions as unacceptable. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is in China, where he met with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi on Monday and on Tuesday. During their talks, the two urged the U.S. to halt unilateral bullying and to stop meddling in other countries' domestic affairs. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on both China and Russia in the past months over various issues. The measures have escalated U.S. tensions with the two countries. Political commentator Qin Dozhu says Washington uses unilateral, coercive measures against other nations to serve its national interests.
We have seen over the past years in particular the frequent use of this unilateral coercive measures against other countries, in particular, for example, Iran, Russia, now China, and many other countries. So you can see the U.S. is trying to achieve its purpose without resorting to war, much costly means, probably. So they are using their financial dominance, basically, to serve their national interests. And facing such a situation, other countries naturally will find a way to avoid the use of dollar or reduce the reliance on the U.S. dollar.
Iran has called for an end to the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which will enter its seventh year on March 26, 2015. In a statement, the Iranian Foreign Ministry also urged an end to the ongoing blockade on Yemen. It issued a statement on the anniversary of the Saudi-led war, which the ministry described as a big crime against the Yemeni people. Tehran denounced Riyadh and its allies for killing civilians on a daily basis. It also denounced the continued military support for the Saudi-led coalition. The Iranian statement stressed that there is no military solution to the crisis in Yemen. It voiced support for any peace initiative that allows Yemenis to decide their future without foreign meddling. Germany says it will impose a strict 5-day shutdown over the Easter holidays next week to contain a third wave of coronavirus.
We are at a place where we are now in a very, very serious situation. The 1st and 3rd of April will be designated one of quiet days with extensive contact restrictions as well as a ban on gatherings between 1st and 5th of April, an extended quiet time over Easter. The point is that over 5 consecutive days, people should stay at home.
Germany is also extending its general lockdown until April 18, reversing a plan to gradually reopen the economy. Authorities say that COVID cases are rising exponentially, and intensive care beds are filling up again. In the past 24 hours, the country has reported nearly 7,500 new COVID cases and 250 related deaths. Elsewhere in Europe, Ukraine registered more than 330 new deaths in the past 24 hours. That was a record daily high. New cases were above 11,400. More than half of all UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunize the entire population by the end of summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution, but as Murtaza Jaffer reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalizing large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas, and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
India is the world's second most populous nation and has seen tremendous growth in the past two decades, but the country is still struggling to feed its large chunk of the population. As Press TV's Munawar Zaman reports, the country produces sufficient food to feed its population, but is unable to provide it access to amid pandemic. Here's more from New Delhi.
This part of the world has been on the limelight since the last few decades for its impressive growth and development. But the benefits of development are not reaching to its impoverished section. India, the world's second most populous nation and a diverse country, is still struggling to feed millions as hunger continues to be a challenging task for successive governments. For those having tough times to feed themselves, growth and development is just for a TV and a newspaper, since their lives have not changed.
This pandemic has created a humanitarian crisis in India. We saw that with the lockdown, millions of people started walking. Now, all of those people, they suddenly went from earning, 10,000, 15,000 to earning zero and having no savings to fall back on.
Based on the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World 2020 report, there are some 189 million undernourished people in India, which accounts to about a 14% of country's overall population, which includes women and children, putting the future generation of the country at huge stake. Experts say government programs and schemes need a vigorous implementation.
It's also a challenge of A, not having enough coverage within the food security law. So like in a place like Delhi, only 37% of the population has access to rations under that food security law, whereas more than 50% of Delhi lives in slum or slum-like conditions.
India's aim to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals by 2030 includes providing nutrition to all, and ending hunger looks like a challenging task for the country, keeping in view the geography and the population. On the other hand, experts say addressing the stark food inequality and robust distribution system is the most vital way forward. Many reports, surveys, and studies suggest that India has the largest number of undernourished people in the world. However, the government has time and again junked these reports, questioning the methodology of their calculating the hunger index, saying India has made progress in feeding the most deprived over the last decade. Experts, however, say the country needs to strengthen its delivery system and programs to achieve a lasting solution. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Hello, welcome to the News Review. Israelis are heading to the polls to cast ballots in the fourth general election in less than 2 years. The latest opinion polls have suggested a continued political deadlock there. None of the Israeli blocs seem likely to secure the required 61 seats for forming a cabinet. The election comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on trial for corruption and faces criticism over his COVID response. Netanyahu has two main opponents. One is Gideon Saar, the leader of Israel's New Hope Party. Another rival is Naftali Bennett, the chairman of the far-right Yamina Party. Netanyahu has remained in power since first inconclusive elections in 2019, based on an emergency agreement. Daud Kutab is a Palestinian journalist joining us from Amman. We also have Nick Napier from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Daud Kutab, if I may, ask you whether any of these candidates, whether it's Netanyahu or any of the other parties, what difference would it make for the lives of Palestinians were any of them to come into power?
Well, there will not be much difference. The different parties or different individuals seeking to become prime minister all come from the anti-Palestinian right-wing party. So it really will not make a difference. The only difference that could be made is if Netanyahu is no longer the prime minister. I think that would diminish the ability of Israel to continue to reject international cooperation, and a new prime minister might need to have much better relations with the rest of the world. Netanyahu seems to have succeeded in getting away with a lot of things that maybe a different prime minister will not.
Puts into question, Mick Napier, perhaps the way that the new U.S. administration is going to work either with Netanyahu or whoever else comes into power regarding the Palestinian issue. I mean, do you see any hopes there, any relief? Some Palestinians actually have hope in this U.S. administration.
Yeah, people can be forgiven for clutching at a straw. No, the reality is these elections look superficially very volatile, very democratic. There's campaigning, posters, real competition. But it's competition, really, where the Palestinians are excluded. Parties which don't recognize Israel as democratic and Jewish face huge hurdles. I mean, Netanyahu is facing problems of corruption. He's as bent as a dog's hind leg, and he's fighting for his political life inside the system. But it's volatile. Gantz, who was a major challenger before, is now getting a derisory opinion poll. But let's remember, Gantz challenged Netanyahu in a previous election, in one of the recent elections, by running a video to boast that he had killed the largest number of Palestinians in Gaza, so please vote for me. And he showed photographs of Palestinian funerals in order to which he had caused in order to boost his election chances. There is a huge consensus among all the Zionist parties, differences, but there's a huge consensus that Palestinians are not to be given full democratic rights. It's now enshrined in Israeli law that Palestinians don't have the democratic rights of Jews across the whole of Palestine. And this is an election which is formal, but it's Jews who will determine the outcome and Palestinians will be observers. And let's remember, there's talk soon of a Palestinian election. And it reminds me that this will take place under military occupation. In South Africa, black people were allowed to vote, but they were on separate voting lists. Palestinians are allowed to vote in the West Bank, but on a separate voting. It's absolutely very, very similar indeed to the South African apartheid system. This is a system where people vote, there is a competition, but Palestinians are inferior economically, politically, militarily, every conceivable way. So it's Israel's not a democracy in any normal sense of the word. You can't have democracy where you killed and drove out the natives and then you allow the dominant group to vote. And let's remember, the biggest human rights group in Israel, B'Tselem, is on a journey, but they recently were forced to conclude that Israel is a Jewish supremacist state from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, from the Lebanese border down to Egypt. And how can it be a Jewish supremacist state and at the same time democratic. It's a charade.
And Dr. Khattab, let me address the same question to you regarding the way that the U.S. administration is going to deal with Israel. You have Biden who has said about Netanyahu at one point that he loves him to death, but he doesn't agree with anything that he says. I'm wondering if there's an ray of hope there in terms of the Palestinian cause when it comes to the way that the U.S. is either going to back or not back Israel on this, whether it's Netanyahu or any other party that comes into power.
Yes, sure. The Biden administration has made it clear that the Palestine-Israel conflict is not a high priority. They are mostly interested in domestic issues, and when it comes to international affairs, they are worried about the Paris Accords, the Iran agreement. So Palestine is way down on the priority list, which is might be good or bad, I'm not sure, but certainly it's not expected to really be a major player, and I don't think President Biden is going to use his political clout to really pressure Israel to making any serious negotiations or compromise.
Okay, thank you for that, Daoud Khattab, Palestinian journalist. And thank you, Mick Napier, from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And that brings us to an end for this news review. Welcome back. 10 people, including a police officer, have been killed in a shooting incident at a supermarket in the U.S. city of Boulder, Colorado. Local police forces, as well as FBI officers, were dispatched to the scene to respond to, quote, an armed and dangerous individual. The injured suspect has been taken into custody. The police say the threat has been eliminated. There is no immediate information on the shooter's identity or motive, but an investigation has been launched into the incident. The United States loses around 33,000 people to gun violence every year. Additionally, more than 100,000 people are shot each year in the country. Former member of the U.S. Marshals Service Matthew Fox says easy access to firearms is the main culprit for shooting incidents in the country.
Well, I mean, it's just like all the rest of them, and we've had quite a few in the United States over the last few years. The bottom line is there are a lot of guns on the streets in the United States. People have access to guns. The concern is a lot of people are anxieties out there. A lot of people are taking out their feelings on going out there trying to do whatever it is, vigilante style. In this particular case, they're doing an investigation, so they don't really know. They're saying they don't really know the motive yet. But, I mean, in the close proximity of the Asian killing, I don't know if this here had anything to do with race, but the bottom line is you got so many people dead, and you got a person that just went in and started shooting. And in the United States, we have so many open facilities where people can just come in with a gun and start firing. That can happen, and we've been seeing it over and over again.
Massive fire has swept through a Rohingya refugee camp in southern Bangladesh, forcing tens of thousands to flee. Bangladeshi officials say the blaze has displaced at least 50,000 refugees. They say that 7 people are feared dead. The blaze broke out in Cox's Bazar on Monday. It's the largest in multiple fires that have hit Rohingya camps in the past months. The cause of the blazes has remained unknown, despite investigations. Rohingya are Muslims from Myanmar. More than 1 million of them are currently living in overcrowded camps in Cox's Bazar region. Most of them went there in 2017, following a Myanmar army crackdown on the community. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians, from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Those two, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think Jews were kind of extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, it only happened to once. Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not after being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this.
It was really interesting to see that Israeli author age over the course of this documentary. But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time, the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary, you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Khayadu Waglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you for that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same. it's different. Its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. That's it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. There are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that, the kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because even this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the U.S. government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world, and the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism, it started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yeah.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audience?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests, and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وما ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Sayyid Wahid Alawi. An Islamic scholar with 16 years of Hawza studies.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and most welcome to the program For Humanity here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about one of the rights in the book, The Treatise of Rights from Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, The Adornment of the Believers, the son of Al-Husayn, alayhum as-salam. And in it he states, the right of him whose advice you seek. وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُشِيرِ إِلَيْكَ فَلَا تَتَّهِمْهُ بِمَا يُوقِفُكَ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ رَأْيِهِ. And the right of him whose advice you seek is that you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. Because it is quite natural that people have different opinions on different topics. And the Imam continues and says, you are free not to accept his advice if you doubt it. However, you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation. In the Noble Quran, it is stated, O you who believe, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْدَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمٌ. O you who believe, avoid most suspicion. Some suspicion is sinful. And in this program, inshallah, we will continue with the effects, the bad effects of this disease, this moral disease that some of us may be inflicted by. Number one, suspicion brings with it bad and evil intention and thoughts about a certain person. And that person may get afflicted by your evil intentions, which is again something which goes against our deen, against our faith and religion. A hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, which says, Allah loves to see people have a beautiful intention towards each other. I would repeat it again because it's so important. Allah loves to see people have a beautiful intention towards each other. Without doubt, dear brothers and sisters, we will get afflicted with this symptom of bad intention if we have suspicion towards others. And Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the one who fixes his thoughts about others, his intention follows suit and will also become good towards others. Number two, psychological pressure in the form of stress, anger, grudge. And those diseases are brought into our home environment, which should be our abode of peace. The Noble Quran says, Darus Salam, the abode of peace, which should be our house, will become Darul Harb, the abode of war. But you see that this grudge and anger and stress that we bring into our house transforms our house to the abode of war. Number three, other symptoms of suspicion is fear and uncertainty and bad self-confidence in different issues. A person who feels like that he or she cannot do much and doesn't take steps to reach his goals and dreams in life is because of his fear and uncertainty and bad self-confidence. And such a person will never take the steps to realize his dreams. I will continue, inshallah, with this topic after the break. So please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We were talking about the right of him whose advice you seek, where Imam Ali Zainul Abidin states in the book, The Treatise of Rights, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُشِيرِ إِلَيْكِ فَلَا تَتَّهِمْهُ بِمَا يُوقِفُكَ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ رَأْيِهِ. And the right of him whose advice you seek is that you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. And he continues and says, you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation. And we were talking about the bad effects, the disease suspicion can have, the bad symptoms that this disease suspicion can have, and what it brings with it. And we were on number four, greed. Greed is another result of suspicion towards others. Number five, stinginess is another result of this disease suspicion. The hadith says stinginess is poverty. Stinginess is poverty. It's equal with poverty. And stinginess in its turn leads to people criticizing you and taking distance from you. A hadith says a stingy person cannot have a friend. These are all the diseases you can get because of being suspicious or having su'ul dhan towards others. And in this case, towards someone who has given you an honest advice, and that advice may be different with your opinion, but the important part here is that that person has given you an advice, and the right that he has upon you is that you treat him good even if you don't like that advice. So again, and in this case, towards someone who has given you an honest advice, even if that advice would be against your liking. I will end with this verse from the Noble Quran. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْدَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمٌ. Avoid most, O you who believe, avoid most suspicion. Some suspicion is sinful. Till next time, dear brothers and sisters, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. And as always, you can forward your questions to us through our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also listen to us through parstoday.com. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.